You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out why old-fashioned physical books may be poised for a comeback.
First, cooking in your own kitchen can be like a home field advantage. You know where everything is. You know the intricacies of the stove settings. You're just more comfortable. But what happens when you're asked to cook a meal in a stranger's kitchen with limited ingredients and you have it all captured on video?
I'm excited. I mean, as long as they have salt and some kind of oil.
I'm certain you'll make something good.
Well, that's good. I'm glad somebody in this car has confidence. I think it's always interesting because you kind of get into these routines.
Yep.
Like when you go to the store, it's like you hit the store and you're like, okay, I'm going to get my broccoli, my peas, I got into dairy. And you just do literally like the same thing
every time you go.
It's kind of nice to go into something like someone else's kitchen and see like, look in their fridge, yep. And like if you open it up and it's Cribs and there's just like Cristal in there and like some like mayonnaze, then you know like
we're gonna make a champagne aioli.
A clip from a new web series produced by Isthmus and Madison. It's called Car to Table. We have David Rodriguez here with us, a host of the series. David, hi.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And Craig Bartlett is with us. He is co-owner of Isthmus. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. How are you guys doing?
Well, good. Craig, let's start off with you. Where did this idea come from?
We picked up, we decided late last fall that we wanted to bring a videographer on board because we wanted to get into some content creation, whether that was just going off of editorial stories. But then we wanted to do some fun stuff, and talking with a client, they wanted to do some food-based stuff, and we said, well, if you give us one of your automobiles to drive around in, we might be able to do some fun things. So came from there.
And David, talk us through what happens in an episode of Car to Table.
Sure. The it actually starts before the episode starts shooting. I go to the grocery store and I pick out some items that I think will be interesting to cook with. I have a limited budget around $10 plus a protein that's in the past been chosen by the people we're cooking for. So that's where it starts. And then I hop in a Mini Cooper and I pick a chef up at his restaurant. And we drive around for a little while and chat and get to know each other. And then we go cook.
So you show up at somebody's house.
That's
but they,
right.
They know you're coming. You don't just knock on doors until somebody's home.
You know, maybe future episodes. But no, they know we're coming. And we hope their kitchen's clean and ready to go, which it has been so far. the chef cooks in their kitchen using anything they have in their cupboards plus what I've provided. So,
and Craig, that's part of the fun here. It's mystery ingredients. The chef doesn't know what's coming.
Correct. We thought the idea started with David driving around. He's got a pretty funny improv background and just kind of trying to see the personalities of some of these chefs. And then we're like, well, what sucks us into watching TV, especially some sort of reality TV? And it's a challenge. So challenging them with having to use Doritos comes in.
And David, talk about how you're doing the shopping beforehand. You've got a protein idea from the recipients of the food. How mean are you as you're picking out the ingredients?
You know, I feel like I've been pretty nice to this point. I don't know that I'll always be nice. I feel like at the end of the day, any chef that works with us is going to want to make something that tastes good. So I don't want to make the challenge ridiculous. But that said, you know, the challenge is there. And after the first episode, we kind of pared down what I was purchasing to make it a little more challenging. The first one, I pretty much just provided a meal that he had to assemble, which he did a fine job on, Tori. Great job. But the second and third episodes, the food was a little more challenging.
But you're not kale, cinnamon gumballs, ice. You know, you're not being mean. You're not really trying to set huge obstacles.
Not yet, but I haven't worked with. I haven't had a chance to work with a chef I don't like yet.
Yet.
And Craig, what's the release schedule? I think there are two when I looked so far.
Yeah, so we put out two. The first one was Chef Tori. The second one was Chef Dan from Heritage. We've got one that should come out here in the next couple of days with Layla from Layla's.
Layla's Persian, yep.
She's been on the show, on our show, actually, yep.
So we can't tell you much about it. What was your line earlier?
Well, the truth is, you know, what I can tell you is that it's Layla from Layla's Persian. What I can't tell you is that she's completely insane. And
so we'll keep that.
It's going to be a good episode.
Okay. Yeah.
This is filmed already?
It is.
Okay. So we're not going to spoil anything for her.
Oh, she knows.
Okay. We're talking about a new car to table video. David Rodriguez is with us. Craig Bartlett. It is a online series here in Wisconsin. A chef, a car, a bag of groceries, and a stranger's house. And let's get into that. Now, these are chefs. These are pros, David. They are used to working in a kitchen that either they've set up or had time to grow familiar with. Mm-hmm. What's it like for them to be in some random kitchen?
Sure. Well, like you said, you know, even to the with a professional chef like Dan Fox or Tori Miller, they're also used to working with a crew of people that have done a good amount of the prep for them. You know, that's work that they've done in their past. But now to the point where they do less of that, a lot of the food is assembled. They're making sure that the plates look good and that the quality's there. So this is different. I mean, you're being tossed into an unfamiliar kitchen with ingredients that maybe you've never used. You know, Tori Miller did seem like he maybe had cooked with Doritos before, but so there the challenge is in that, and also you have to think on the fly. It's not like you can sit down and with your sous and write a menu plan. It's you have an hour. And this is what you've got.
And I noticed one of the rules, Craig, is the chefs get to bring something, gear or a favorite ingredient. And in the first two, they both brought the same thing. What did they bring?
Their knives.
Their knives.
Yeah.
Which I think I would hesitate to put my knives before a pro chef because they are in various states of sharp and dull. And that, so this is a key. Well, and you're a chef yourself, David.
The truth is, a knife roll has a lot more than just knives in it. Mm-hmm. So there are an assortment of tools in there that make it so if you have this with you, you know you at least have all of the tools you need to cook anywhere. Plating spoons, if you're trying to do really fine plating, tweezers. If not, there's graters. You can grate. You can do lemon zest or grate garlic or cheese. So all of the tools that you would need, the bare minimum tools that you would need to make a pretty decent meal.
And not something you can count on people to have or to have in the quality, I guess, you're used to as a chef.
Exactly.
So there are a lot of food shows out there, Craig. We apparently love to watch other people cooking, whether or not we do it ourselves. What do you think is up with that?
Madison specifically, we've got such a fantastic food scene, and it's such a part of, you know, kind of what the city has become with the influx of youth with the Epics or the Zendesks. And I think the ability to get in front of these people and see what they do and get to know who they are, that doesn't really get old. So, you know, I think we're onto something, and I think we'll keep tweaking it. We'll keep making it harder on David and harder on the chefs.
And David, do you hope, you know, seeing pro chefs cook in everyday kitchens, do you think people watching this might be inspired to get a little more adventurous on their own?
I think that is part of the hope of the show. I know at some point our goal is to have it so that you can access the recipes in some way, be that online or at the end of the episode. So, I think part of it is to inspire people, and you know, it also is, it's entertainment, so.
And Craig, I think a lot of people might listen and think, yeah, I'd like to have a pro chef come to my house and cook me a meal. How can people out there sign up if they want to get on the list?
Well, we've had to seed the first couple episodes because we're not a big production, so we couldn't shoot 10 shows. So we've had to seed the first couple, but I think we'll have a little ask and some information at the end of the next episode where people will be able to submit online. They're going to have to show us, you know, what condiments they have in the fridge and some photos of the kitchen to make sure David can get in there.
And Craig, what's a link that people can find?
Right now, you can just go to isthmus.com/card-to-table.
And David, you wanted to throw something in?
No, I think we've covered everything.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, David, for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it. It's great to be here.
Craig, thanks for coming up.
Thank you.
I've been talking to David Rodriguez, host of the Car to Table video series. We got a link, by the way, on our Facebook page, Central Time Facebook page. Also, Craig Bartlett, co-owner of Isthmus, the media entity behind the show.
Sales of ebooks in the U.S. fell by almost 19% during the first 9 months of 2016, with a similar trend in the U.K., and sales of e-readers like Kindle have been on the decline since 2011. Some culture watchers are calling it the result of digital fatigue, a trend that parts ways with the music and the TV industries.
To help us get a handle on why ebook sales are down while hardcover and paperback sales are up, we thought we'd ask one of Wisconsin's own celebrated novelists, Jane Hamilton.
Jane Hamilton is the critically acclaimed author of numerous best-selling books, including A Map of the World, The Book of Ruth, and her latest, which is just out in paperback. It's called The Excellent Lombards. She lives and writes in an orchard farmhouse in Wisconsin. Jane, hi. Thanks for talking today.
Thanks for having me.
So again, sales of e-readers and e-books are down. Hardcover and paper book sales, however, are up a little more modestly. But what do you think is going on there?
Well, I'm not a sociologist, but I'd like to tell you my two experiences with encountering readers who were sitting next to me on an airplane. Well, and one was a train. The first was a train. The guy on the train, and I got to talking with him, and this was at the beginning of books on devices, and he learned that I was a writer, and he whipped out his iPad, and he downloaded my most recent book, and he said, "This is going to be so much fun. I've never read a book in front of the author before." And although I didn't yet know him well and never came to know him well, my instinct was, this is not going to be fun. And in fact, he was so distracted with his gadget that it took him the 3 hours of the train trip to get to page 18. And so, you know, he was doing all kinds of things on the gadget because, of course, the gadget has the world. And as opposed to an earlier time when I sat next to somebody on an airplane who'd been reading one of my books, and these are the only two times that I've ever sat next to anybody who was reading my book, I just have to say. And she was reading a hard copy, and I said nothing. And, you know, it was very public. We could see what she was reading, and yet the book was just the thing itself. And it only held that particular world. And I don't know. I think that people might have a hunger just for having one thing unto itself in their hands.
And what about that notion of it possibly being digital fatigue as well, that it could be that people are tired of having that device that holds the world, maybe, and they want the one thing? Are people uniquely maybe feeling this way around books?
I think that's very possibly true, and I think that, you know, it'd be interesting to chart to see who's reading what genre on what device, because it might break down by genre. I have no idea if that's true, but I think it might be possible when you look at the bestseller lists. But I think also that people may have realized that if we're going to have brick and mortar bookstores, you really have to support them. And you have to buy real books, and you know, and there's such notable and dynamic and vibrant booksellers on the scene now. People like Ann Padgett, who have said publicly, she owns a bookstore in Nashville, and she basically says, if I see you in my store, and you're noting an ISBN number, and I see that you're going to order it, you know, online, I will kill you. So. So, you know, the booksellers have been a force, I think, behind this trend, and also probably the millennials who grew up reading Harry Potter and you know, had real hardcover books every however many years it took to crank them out, and just the joy of having that experience with a real book, I think, is probably part of it, too.
Right, that's an interesting one. I mean, I'm not a millennial. I'm a little too old to be a millennial. I'm a Gen Xer, but I was there in line with all, I guess, the millennials waiting to get my Harry Potter book. And it was something that felt really special to have that physical book in your hand. You could look at the cover art, and books even, you know, they have a smell. And smell of paper. So there is something that's more of the senses about a book than there is about, yeah, a device.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you can see them on your shelf, and you can remember what you've read. I mean, I know you can look at your list on your device also, but I think it's very different to have them in front of you in your workspace or your living room or wherever. And I think also we're so used to reading quickly online and carelessly, and maybe having the book, the real physical object, allows us to slow down in every way and to read more carefully. Again, I'm just I haven't done any research, but that's my hope, I guess.
We're talking with Wisconsin novelist Jane Hamilton right now. She's the author of numerous books, including The Book of Ruth and The Excellent Lombards. We're talking about why it may be that readers are turning back toward physical books and away from e-books and e-readers. We're seeing that trend from 2016. And Jane, what we're saying, you know, is there is this case to be made for the physical book. And yet, on the other hand, there is a tandem minimalist craze right now. People getting rid of everything, but basically, you know, exactly what they need. They have one plate, one fork, and I'm assuming that for these people, having one device to hold all of their books would be pretty seductive. Do you think there is value in having a physical book, maybe gathering dust when you're not actually reading that book and you could just have one device?
Veronica, you're talking to a dinosaur. yes, I think there is value. Absolutely. I don't know. I want to get rid of everything too. I understand the impulse, but the books for me are the last to go because they are really a marker of the stages of life that you've gone through and the things you've thought about. And I think that they are more emblematic of your phases than any other objects you might own. You know, there was the Carlos Castaneda phase and the Herman Hesse phase and the Faulkner phase. Mm-hmm. You could just see it all there. So I would think that when the kids get older, they might wish that they had a little bit more evidence of the life that they've led.
And I'm curious about what our listeners think about this. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you prefer the actual physical book, or do you think you like the streamlined experience of an e-reader? Do you get more distracted with an e-reader, or is it kind of the same no matter what format you're reading on? If you do like those physical books, what is it that you like about them? You can call us at 800-642-1234, and you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Jane, let's talk a little about the role of libraries. Again, now you can get e-books at the library, but also, you know, of course, they have shelves and shelves of physical books, and you got a soft spot yourself for interlibrary loans. What do you like about that?
Well, I've gotten things from outside of Wisconsin every now and then. I got this screenplay by Terrence Malick from the University of Vermont once. That was a thrill. It's interesting to see what is being held where, and then it comes to you, and you know, other people have read it. There's a kind of wonderful communal feeling about having a book from, you know, Rhinelander. So I don't know. That's just one of the joys of being in the library. And I love being in the stacks. And I hope that the physical books still keep being a feature of a public library for as long as I'm living. I like to wander and see what's there, and you know, be taken by surprise.
Let's take a caller now. We have Darlene joining us in Tomahawk. Darlene, hi.
Hi. I was just listening to this show. Thank you for taking my call. And I wanted to say that up here in Tomahawk, it's unaffordable to keep buying books, so I like to use my library. And I read on average at least 100 books handheld per year. Mm-hmm. And I also have a Kindle, because if the library doesn't have it, I have to go digitally to the library loan, and I've read several hundred of those over the course of
a
couple of years.
Darlene's a voracious reader. She's an omnivore, though, Jane. She likes the Kindle for some things and the physical books for other things. Is that a nice medium road to walk?
I think any road you walk is fine, Veronica. I absolutely can understand having a reader for traveling, and I think, you know, it's wonderful to have access to all mediums. And but I wonder, Darlene, why you don't read everything on your reader.
No, because I do prefer to have a handheld page turner, and I find when I'm reading the Kindle right now, but I've got two handheld books next, And when I go from the Kindle to the handheld, I find I'm touching the side of the pages of the book. I'm carrying over my Kindle and forget where I'm at. But I do prefer the handheld page turners.
I like the term handheld. That's new to me. Do other people use that term, Jane, instead of physical book handheld?
I've never heard that. Is that your term, Darlene?
Don't know. It's what I've been using.
All right. I like it. Let's get one more quick call in. Donna joining us from Brookfield. Donna, hi.
Hi. How are you today?
Good. Thanks.
I just wanted to say that I agree 100% with this whole thing about digital fatigue. As a teacher, at the school that I work at, we have one-to-one devices. So every student in the middle school and the high school has a Chromebook. And they're doing their work on Chromebooks all the time. And they're reading novels, they download novels, they read the novels. And the kids just don't read for the sake of reading anymore. They're hunting and pecking and they're looking for answers. If I'm asking them to look for figurative language, they're just looking for that phrase. They're not reading for the enjoyment of reading.
Donna, thank you for that. And Jane, do you think there's something to that, just briefly, that when we're on an e-reader or a computer, that we're not reading for the sake of reading anymore?
Well, that's certainly my experience as a reader and being in front of the computer as much as I am. But that anecdote sounds harrowing, and I think it would be great if we could get back to more fiction in the schools and real books.
And Jane, do you have a favorite book in the last couple seconds together here that you find especially beautiful and you like the way it looks and it just makes you feel good?
I've been reading Jane Gardam, who's a British novelist, and her novels are published by Europa. And I have to say, there's kind of a lot of typos in them, but it's beautiful paper. They're just really lovely paperbacks, and she is a writer who, you read her and you have automatic happiness.
Jane, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was Jane Hamilton. She is a critically acclaimed author of numerous books, including Disobedience and her newest, The Excellent Lombards. And we were talking about the pleasures of actual physical books as sales of ebooks and e-readers decline.
Now, as the Washington Post reported last night, an anonymous source in the White House claimed that President Trump had shared classified intelligence with Russian officials during a recent meeting at the White House. Since then, President Trump has said he was within his rights to share information, and that sentiment was echoed today by members of his White House staff.
But the news could have far-reaching implications, both for the United States and for its allies, chief among them whether intelligence will be shared in the future and whether foreign countries can trust President Trump to safeguard classified information.
Nehal Tusi joins us now. She's a foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Nehal, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
A lot of reporting and analysis on this, Nehal. You wrote, quote, America's foreign allies are being forced to grapple with a highly sensitive question. Is it still safe to share information with U.S. intelligence agencies? Except you wrote that in January. This is something that foreign intelligence agencies, this is a shoe they've been waiting for to drop, it sounds like.
That's right. I mean, this was months ago where I was talking to people and they were very concerned about this. U.S. intelligence agencies are, you know, famed for their prowess, but they rely tremendously on partners overseas, especially when it comes to the Middle East and areas where U.S. officials don't necessarily always have the cultural and linguistic backgrounds to blend in. And so these partnerships are very much at stake when it comes to this sort of thing, because a lot of the countries overseas are very skittish about openly cooperating with the United States. And so if you have a president who is cavalier in the way he treats intelligence, some are very concerned that it could lead to some of these other countries stopping their cooperation.
So what do we know about the information that President Trump apparently shared with the Russian officials? And he tweeted that he had shared some kind of information. What do we know about the intelligence?
Well, we don't know a heck of a lot that's definitively established, but if you look at the New York Times reports and especially the Washington Post reports, we know that it was information that came from Israel, that it involved some sort of the Islamic State terrorist organization, and that Trump may have mentioned a city that was involved in some sort of a terrorist plot. And the name of that city is what some people are especially worried about him mentioning, because they feel like the Russians could be able to deduce the source of the intelligence, or at least the way that it was obtained through knowing the name of the city. So it's a wide variety of things that involves, you know, Israel and just some very sensitive stuff when it comes to the war on terror. And so people are just concerned that he might have given too much away, even if he himself did not say what the source was or how exactly the U.S. got the information. The Russians are pretty good at connecting the dots and backtracking and figuring out how the U.S. gets what it gets.
And with this new piece of information that the source of this intelligence was Israel, people worried that, okay, if you're sharing information with Russia, they coordinate to some extent intelligence with places like the Syrian government and the Iranian government, not friends of Israel. Is that something that could particularly damage intelligence cooperation?
Yeah, I mean, I want to be really clear that the Israelis themselves have not officially, you know, confirmed this. This is from a New York Times report. But yes, I mean, one of the big concerns that the Israelis have is this Russian-Iranian relationship. And when they see Trump being cozy with Russia, they just worry that somehow some information is going to reach the Iranians. And Israelis view Iran as really a huge threat to their country. And so this is one of the most fascinating things, actually, about covering intelligence, is that, you know, one particular country like the U.S. can be friends and or partners or allies or whatever you want to call it with two other countries that don't necessarily get along themselves. And so you want to, when you get information from one country, you don't necessarily want to share it with every other country that you get along with, because they might not all get along. So it's this really weird puzzle, and Trump is inexperienced, and so he gets in this situation and he wants to make friends. He wants to ingratiate himself with some folks, and sometimes he apparently just says things that can come back to haunt him.
Talking to Nihal Tusi from Politico, looking at President Trump's revelation to the Russians, some piece of intelligence information. People worried this could ultimately compromise a source from a U.S. ally. Concerns about whether U.S. partners in intelligence will be as willing to share information. A lot of response from the White House since this came out. Let's give a listen to National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster. He talked to reporters at the White House earlier today. Here's some of what he had to say about this.
Are you denying that you revealed information that was given to the U.S. by an intelligence partner?
So what we don't do is discuss what is and what wasn't classified. What I will tell you is, in the context of that discussion, what the president discussed with the foreign minister was wholly appropriate to that conversation and is consistent with the routine sharing of information between the president and any leaders with whom he's engaged.
But was it information that the U.S. received from an intelligence partner?
I'm not going to be the one to confirm that sort of information that could jeopardize our security.
That U.S. allies that do have these type of intelligence sharing relationships with the U.S. will stop providing that information?
No, I'm not concerned at all. That conversation was wholly appropriate to the conversation, and I think wholly appropriate what the expectations are of our intelligence partners.
Let's get into a couple of the points there, Nihal. He's saying it's appropriate. It is legal, it sounds like, for a president to share even classified information. This is a case where if the president does it, it is legal. But from an intelligence perspective, is it something that people view as appropriate to do?
Well, no. I mean, people in the intelligence community are very concerned about this. And, you know, one thing you have to remember is that when H.R. McMaster and other Trump aides come out into the public, they're not going to admit that the president did anything wrong. And if anything, this could be a counterintelligence measure. H.R. McMaster may be insisting that this was wholly appropriate and perfectly fine in a bid to send a signal to the Russians that, hey, guys, nothing to see here. You know, you don't need to bother digging or putting any dots together because there's nothing there. I mean, this could be their attempt to simply try to cast the light away from this. And so, you know, this is the thing. It's multiple layers, and one of those issues where what is the reality? What is the truth? Well, you know, if we ever got those transcripts, you know, and potential recordings, maybe we would find out.
And that last question we heard there seems to be the big question on the table. Will intelligence partners, allies, or people we cooperate with on an ad hoc basis, are they going to be as willing to share intelligence with the United States if they're worried that the president of the U.S. might share that information, maybe compromise sources with other parties?
My guess is that this is going to be very much a case-by-case situation. I don't think any government is going to adopt a wholesale policy of saying, we're never going to cooperate again. They're going to look at each situation, as they always do, and say, is it a good idea to deal with them on this or is it not? And let's not forget, the U.S. is a heavyweight when it comes to sharing information itself. So some of these governments rely on the U.S. to give them information more than we rely on these governments to give us information. So this is not, you know, a one-way street here. The U.S. has a lot of leverage. But, you know, this incident certainly has sent a strong signal. And one thing that might have happened, one of the reasons that this might have leaked, is that maybe people in the CIA and other agencies don't ever want to see this happen again. So they went ahead and leaked this and want this to get out there just to send a warning to the White House that they need to be more careful.
Right. The president and some of his advisors have raised that point again, as has happened in the past. The problem here is the leak. We need to figure out who's doing this and put a stop to it. I mean, somebody who leaked this is, I guess, leaking the existence of classified information themselves. Is that a concern?
Well, yeah, I mean, leaks are going to be a constant problem for this particular White House, it seems. They have been. But I just think that this is their effort to shine the light away from what is the bigger issue, which is that the president allegedly shared critical information with a U.S. rival. And that's really important. And, yeah, I mean, it's just there's a certain level. If the president actually did this, it's really striking in particular because he was so harsh about others who have leaked information. And this is it's just one of these very weird things with the White House complaining about something that they themselves are doing. It's like when they complain about, you know, the media using anonymous sources, but then they themselves do so anonymously. It's just... it's a very strange time to be in Washington right now.
We're talking to Nahal Tusi. She's a foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. She's with us to talk about the news that President Trump shared information, probably classified information, it sounds like, with Russian officials during a recent White House meeting.
And you can join the conversation. What was your reaction to this news yesterday? Do you think it was appropriate for the president to share that information, or do you think he was out of line? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about President Trump revealing classified information to Russian officials during a recent White House meeting. Nahal Tusi is with us, foreign affairs correspondent for Politico.
And you can join the conversation. What do you think this news says about the Trump White House? How do you think this could affect U.S. foreign relations? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
Let's go to our callers now. Mark is with us in Milwaukee. Mark, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. You know, I've been hearing about this for the past day, and I just, you know, an interesting thing is that, you know, this was information that was shared by another world leader to our president, who I'm not necessarily a supporter of our president, but, you know, and then he gets in trouble for sharing it with somebody else. I mean, isn't that what they're supposed to do? Isn't sharing, like, what the intelligence community is supposed to do? I really don't see what the big deal is about all this, you know?
Got it. Mark, thanks for the call. Nahal, is this just how it works?
Well, when it comes to counterterrorism, there is a tremendous amount of sharing internationally, in particular when it comes to counterterrorism. But in this particular case, the Israelis and the Americans do have a longstanding intelligence sharing agreement. But Russia is a U.S. rival, and the Russians and the Americans have long been nemeses on the intelligence front. So when you look at what all is involved, the Russian relationship with Syria, the Russian relationship with Iran, sure, if Israel gave the information to the United States and then the United States somehow gave it to Russia, there are some potential repercussions for Israel because of the Iran connection. And then Israel in the future may say, we don't want to share as much information with the United States because we're worried that it's going to come back to haunt us. So this isn't just, you know, a linear thing. It involves a number of different players and partners, and it just becomes very, very complicated very, very fast.
Mark, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Dennis in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
I know presidents are allowed to declassify things. I just wonder, are there procedures they're supposed to follow, or are they just allowed to blurt out whatever they want to say? Okay.
Dennis, thanks for the call. Nahal, what do you think?
You know, that's a really good question, and I've seen different things on that. I mean, some people say there are normally procedures that they are supposed to follow, but it's their discretion at the end of the day. So my understanding is that he probably, you know, did not break any sort of a law. But whether it was something that he should have done is a different question as to whether it's something he can technically do legally.
Thanks for the call. Yeah, generally in the past, would it be something like the president would work with intelligence officials to talk about what kind of information and how they would share that information with another foreign dignitary?
Yeah, I mean, that's actually one of the interesting things is that they, when it comes to sharing information with foreign government, the U.S. officials involved are very careful about how they share that information, exactly what they say, what things they don't include as opposed to what they do include. So it is a very, very complicated procedure in some cases. That being said, one of the story I'm working on right now is about a lot of U.S. intelligence officials themselves wondering how much they can share with the U.S. president, with Trump, because now there's some concerns that maybe if they give too much detail in their presidential daily briefings, that could wind up hurting sources on the ground. And, you know, the entire intelligence community is really geared toward giving the president what he needs, so I don't think there's going to be, at the end of the day, much holding back of information, but it is a dilemma facing the intelligence community because of this unusual nature of the Trump presidency.
There's been a lot of reaction in Congress, some, including some Republicans, one member of Wisconsin's Republican delegation saying, yeah, we want more information, maybe a transcript about this. I want to give a listen to a Democrat, though, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. He had this to say on the Senate floor today.
If the reporting is accurate, in one fell swoop, the president could have unsettled our allies, emboldened our adversaries, endangered our military and intelligence officers world over, and exposed our nation to greater risk. Given the gravity of the matter, we need to be able to quickly assess whether or not this report is true and what exactly was said. So, I am calling on the White House to make the transcript of the meeting with the Russian foreign minister and ambassador available to the congressional intelligence committees as soon as possible. The White House should make the transcript of the meeting available immediately to the congressional intelligence committees. And if the president has nothing to hide, he should direct that the transcript of the meeting be made available. The members who sit on those committees have the necessary clearances to review the transcript and any related summary of the president's meeting with the Russians. I agree with the senior senator from Maine that this briefing should happen immediately. Those committees would be able to help establish the facts before we grapple with the potential consequences.
So transcripts not available to the public, but to these key congressional intelligence committees. What are you watching for next there, Nehal, with getting this information, maybe a briefing or the transcripts to these congressional committees?
I am not hopeful that this is actually going to happen. I think it's especially less likely to happen because the Democrats are insisting on it. The Republicans, quite honestly, some of them have been somewhat vocal, but many of them have not said very much about this. And so I just think that it's just something that the Democrats can use to score political points with, but I would really be surprised if the White House shared anything.
Talking to Nehal Tusi from Politico, looking at this kerfluffle over the release of classified information by the president, apparently, to Russian officials. Reaction to that. Back to your calls now. Catherine with us in Milwaukee. Catherine, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
I think it is a continuation of bizarreness. You go all the way back to Comey. But real quickly, I thought that this meeting was supposed to be a get-acquainted meeting. So how these topics came up at all is a mystery. And the other thing that I find perplexing is they say that, you know, this was just sort of a slip of the tongue. But what prompted that slip of the tongue? How do you get that cozy with people you have just met? And so that's just my comment about it. It should never have happened. And the other part that I guess I do want to say is certainly, while the president can tweet that he has the right to do what he did, I think it is also incumbent upon him to then say, why did he do that?
Catherine, thanks for the call. And Nihal, I think Catherine's asking the question. A lot of intelligence agencies in the U.S. and around the world are asking what led him to do that.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a mystery because they're not going to give us too many details about exactly how the conversation went. Frankly, when this conversation happened, you know, only Russian media were involved, were allowed to even witness the initial greetings between the people involved. And this is just something that's really going to further the narrative that Trump is too cozy with Russia. I mean, what's astonishing about this is that it comes, you know, as the FBI is investigating his campaign's alleged ties with the Russians and Russia's alleged interference in the U.S. election. I mean, it's just adding to this narrative that Trump is too close to the Kremlin, and it's just kind of amazing that this happened. But you know, if you ask the White House, they will say, well, you know, this is coming from people who want to undermine this administration, and they're going to question the source of the leaks. So it's just a tale that I think we haven't really seen the end of. But frankly, things just move so quickly in Washington these days that who knows? By tomorrow, we may be talking about something completely different.
So people in the United States intelligence community, what do you imagine they're doing or know they're doing to try to mend fences with intelligence partners around the world?
Well, I imagine there's a lot of conversations and a lot of phone calls right now between various people on the ground, you know, contacting their counterparts overseas to reassure them. It's especially important for people in the Middle East, the Jordanians, for example, of course, the Israelis, the Egyptians, just to say, look, you know, we're still careful. You can trust us. Because we need you. But again, it's also important to point out that the U.S. is also considered a critical intelligence partner for many of these countries abroad, especially in Europe. And so the idea that they could just simply cut off, or that they would simply cut off contact, it's unrealistic. But, you know, we could see some, well, I don't know if we will see it because it'll probably be behind closed doors, but there could be some modifications to some of the arrangements over time. Some of the modifications may happen without the U.S. even realizing that it's officially happening because the other country may never tell them.
Right. We might still be getting information, but maybe they're couching it differently, scrubbing some details that could be compromising.
Exactly. Exactly.
We'll leave it there for now. Nihal, thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Nihal Tusi. She's a foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. She joined us today to talk about the news that President Trump had apparently revealed classified information to top Russian officials during a recent meeting at the White House. Still time for you to share your thoughts on this story, by the way. You can find a link over at the Central Time Facebook page, and you can put your thoughts up there or questions about this issue. It's something we'll continue to cover in the days to come.